Welcome to Simulcast. I'm Victoria Brazel.
I'm Ben Simon.
I'm Jesse Spur.
I'm Jess Stokes Parrish, and you're listening to Simulcast.
Connecting the healthcare simulation community.
So welcome to Simulcast. I'm Victoria Brazel, and I'm joined again by Ben Simon for our April Journal Club. How are you, Ben?
Mate, I'm very good, very happy to be here. And as we were discussing, I think this is going to be a ripper episode.
I know, four good articles. And I think you like the ones that are my articles as much as I like the ones that are your articles. So we'll get into it. No particular news, I don't think. People looking forward to CSAM, which is coming up in June. And we've seen on LinkedIn the various keynote speakers being released. So we're looking forward to listening to them and the many other people who have abstracts. So Simulcast will be appearing at CSAM. We'll be running a live podcast session doing one of these journal clubs. So hopefully some of our listeners will make it along to that, Ben.
I have faith.
All right. We'll see them in Prague. All right, why don't we start with our first article then, which is one that I'm doing, and the title of it is I Hate Sim, Using Psychotherapeutic Concepts to Help Educators Attend to Challenging States of Mind During Simulation Pre-Briefs. And this is by Drake and Duke, and it's a concepts and commentary paper in simulation in healthcare. So what's it about? It's about pre-briefing. But it builds on a lot of the existing literature, which we've discussed here at length, about how we think about psychological safety in sim, i.e. how do we create an environment for novel, robust learning and reflection on performance. But what is different about this one? It uses a lot of concepts from psychotherapeutic literature, which is not my wheelhouse, Ben. I know you've got a lot of friends who are in this area. But in particular, this concept of standing alongside our learners rather than necessarily trying to fix them. Now, the authors, there's two of them, and they come from the Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, Children's Hospital, and they situate this as saying this is the way they have thought about pre-briefing at their sim program. And the first author is a clinical psychologist, so this is important to point out. And in their introduction, they start with a quote, "Don't just do something, stand there." And new to me, apparently this is an idea that's well understood in psychotherapeutic ideas, in that we can have two different states of mind when we come across someone who's expressing an opinion or an emotion. And our habitual response is to do something about it and have a reflexive response. Whereas in the psychotherapeutic literature, they say, well, maybe you just stand there and listen. And the words they use here is have some meditative curiosity and self-reflection. And so maybe we want to think a little bit more about that stance in some of our sim learning conversations. So they go through the literature on pre-briefing and how it supports psych safety. There's a lovely list in there from the sort of INAXL best practice in pre-briefing, and I think that is always worthy of a recap. But then they go beyond this and say, look, pre-briefing isn't just transactional. It's essentially very relational, and it's about how we establish trusting relationships and we pay attention to our stance like a therapist would. So even if we start out curious and collaborative, various things might happen to pull us away from this stance, and they describe us having an aversive affect sometime to things that happen in sim, like when we get defensive, when learners tell us that the sim is unrealistic. And they talk about a concept that sounds like big words, but I think I know what they mean, this epistemic trust. Building trust with anxious learners involves curiosity about difficult feelings that may feel aversive or unpleasant. Now, all of this seemed sort of difficult for me to follow, but I was just keeping up. But then they have this beautiful table one, which just really put it into practice for me. And it involved imagining a learner coming in and just saying, "I hate sim." And it gave us three different examples of how we might respond. And one is just to be defensive and give up. The second, which I've seen myself do lots of times, is this attempt to try and get people feeling better so that we feel better, and saying things like, "Hey, well, I hope it's better today. And, you know, we've done all this good stuff," because we desperately want to have this reflexive response. But this article says, maybe you just go, "Huh, okay, tell me more about that," which I find very hard to do. And it works through a conversation that you might have with this learner which basically stops trying to fix them and tell them they should feel happier about sim and not hate it so much, and instead really explores why people are feeling the way they do. And I'm going to quote from the paper here. This example illustrates the dangers of, and I quote, prematurely pulling learners away from a skeptical position without first validating that position. And so if we do something like that, the learner can feel unheard and engage less wholeheartedly. So even though we want people to feel better, paradoxically, they might not do that. So this is very interesting to me. Now, they have lots of other concepts in the paper, and I'm not going to do it justice, but things we have touched on before, but I think told from a different stance about rapport management, about trust, this idea of containment. They bring in cognitive load theory and growth mindset. But I love one of their conclusions was that the educator is, in fact, the most important piece of simulation equipment. So very interesting article, Ben. I'll have to say one of my reflections was, you'll blush here, it made me think of you, because I think I've always thought about pre-briefing as, you know, having a strategy and some tactics and some conversational techniques, whereas this is all about the values you bring into it, the stance you have, and I think that's one of the things you have taught me. That said, I think looking through that example, you have to have a bit of time to do this. You certainly cannot just do this in a 15-minute debrief if someone walks in and says, I hate sim. And the other thing that I kind of maybe was thinking was missing here, I think we should be asking learners to have a bit more responsibility to engage in these conversations productively. Like, sure, you get to say, I hate sim, but come on, you're in a group of people and that's just not a very helpful way to spend the next hour. So maybe you just have to focus on some things that you do find realistic and that are useful to talk about. Maybe we should ask a bit more of them. So I love the article. I also, though, think in some of our time-constrained debriefs, it may be hard to do this good work. But what did you think, Ben?
Oh, Vic. Well, thanks for that compliment, firstly. But look, we are in April 2024, and I am putting this down. I reckon this will be my favorite article this year. Calling it now. I loved it. You could literally hook this one up to my veins and I would just infuse it in, tug all the Ben Simon heartstrings. And I love the points that you raised. So in particular, I think that you highlight that sim participants are not psychotherapy patients. And I think that's an important highlight, actually, because this stance is heavily influenced from learnings from the psychotherapeutic space. And I think that is actually really helpful learning. And I agree that it would be easy for us to just pathologize participants as sort of a different type of passive, really, isn't it? And inserting a different lens that isn't necessarily theirs. And so I love that you highlight that. But I do feel like there is so much overlap between group therapy and a debriefing circle in so many ways. And I think a lot of these principles really align. And I feel like this article in particular has introduced language and concepts that I've understood but couldn't really name as well as the authors do here. And I think I, as you know, have been really immensely frustrated at the way we teach pre-briefing in particular. And I see a lot of sweet, really caring, highly invested educators just struggling with enormous checklists and this for a pre-brief, and this idea that if we just list enough things that we can prepare them for, somehow trust will be generated. And I just watch it and my heart breaks because these checklists and things are disconnecting them from their learners. They're intimidating people by making it seem like this enormous thing when it doesn't have to be, and actually sort of breaking down that trust, even though it's so well-intentioned. And so I love that the article highlights the centrality of trust. I think at the end of the day, that is all this is. You know, do I trust you? Do I trust this system? And do I trust the information that I'm being given? And I also think this is one of probably the only one I've read of a very few articles that highlights what we contribute as debriefers with our emotional responses and acknowledges that we bring needs and treatment behaviors to an educational experience. And that means we shape these interactions in sometimes unproductive ways. And I think we've seen a lot of essentially positivist stances on pre-briefing previously and psych safety in general, where we think we can exclusively shape it and generate it by being master craftsmen. And this is the first one again. Actually, this is really complex, and we need to think about that very carefully. I love the table as well, but I think I also really love the digital supplement from Great Ormond Street Hospital Clinical Simulation Center. And their pre-brief, quote-unquote, checklist is 5 key points, but they're not things that you have to say. So the 5 key points, you know, check your stance, which is essentially saying, physician, know thyself. What are you bringing into this room? What's your energy and what's your perspective? Establish a secure setting. Explore experiences. Agree on learning objectives, which I really loved as well, just making those explicit, clear, and also a little bit of a shared responsibility. And then my heart sank a little bit with the last one because discuss the fiction contract, because I still feel like that's – and then when you actually read the sub-points to the fiction contract that they talk about, actually – it's the things that really matter, like actually abolishing a fiction contract and saying, no, the aim is not for this to look like it's real or for you to think that it is. It's to take away clinically relevant learning. And I thought that was a fantastic stance to be on. I'll stop talking now. I'm getting too excited.
No, I could not agree more. And I think it has influenced what I do. And you're right, this idea about let me just tell you a million things you can and can't do in that room. We know why we do it, because we're actually feeling for them. So two points I wanted to agree with. One is, it is very psychotherapeutic to recognize your own feeling, your sort of countertransference, and to use that in a diagnostic way instead of just a reflexive way. One of the few things I remember from my psychiatry training. And I think that is difficult because we have very strong reactions to the reactions of the participants. And if they say they hate sim, we've got so much invested in this sim that we hate their feeling. And this aversive affect is very real. Or even if they have this negative self-perception, we don't want them to feel that way because we want to have a happy conversation. So I think this recognizing our contribution to these somewhat pathological conversations is real. I think your other point about what do we do about the checklist, and I don't know the answer to this because, once again, it's very well motivated. People just want to tell people what they can and can't do. One of the things that I have started to do, and I realize now this gave me a name for it, like you said, building the trust, is what I normally say is there's a number of things in here that aren't real for you. Our main way that we're going to help you with this is we're going to have our faculty member X who's going to be in there with you. And that person will be trying to help you with any of the things that you feel like you are not sure how to do them. And he or she is going to help you. And when I realize that now, what I'm trying to do is say there is someone in there that you can trust who will be helping. And probably I should just stop there instead of explaining a bunch of things about the monitor and the drugs and the cannulas and the whatever else.
Yeah, I think, the original papers often talked about things like clarity. And I think we've unfortunately taken that to an extreme, but actually clarity of that simple haiku of there's someone in the room who's here to help you. I think that's actually the real clarity that's needed in terms of building that trust.
All right, you've called it, Ben, April 2024. Yeah. Maybe this is the paper of the year, but we've got some more to talk about, so you better have a go at another one now.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to switch gears quite aggressively here. We're going to move from a very psychologically aware paper to one that's got a very strong systems focus. So this paper is entitled Harnessing System-Focused Simulation, Debriefing and FMEA to Inform Healthcare Blood Transfusion Safety and Policy. That's from Moret Dubay et al. And published in IJOS. And so, as you know, VB, I'm currently on the warpath when it comes to healthcare algorithms and procedures. And I think they're often great in principle, and then they're so often just poorly designed, difficult to interpret, that nobody can actually use them in the way they're intended to be used. And I've been working, as you know, on our pediatric MHP for Metro North for a while now. So it was very exciting for me to see this publication because I thought, oh, I can quote it lots, hopefully. So this is from Moret Dubay et al. And on their approach to harnessing translational sim and what's called failure mode effects analysis to improve the safety of their hospital's blood transfusions. And importantly, this article isn't a trial. It's a paper that describes the team's approach to improvement. And I do think there's a number of little details in here that are practically useful to think about and potentially incorporate into our practice. To synthesize it all, basically a team of human factors experts, simulationists, and clinicians teamed up in response to a reasonably dense series of reported safety issues in this hospital's blood transfusions. From an input process output perspective, they looked at all the existing data that they had from safety reports and sentinel events and compiled those into themes. This is pre-simulation, obviously. This is the hard kind of data work first. And then they identified two phases in blood transfusions where errors were most likely to occur, which was in the lab when matching and dispensing blood products and on the ward during checks and administration. And I thought that was a nice little example of utilizing the pre-existing data that's there, not necessarily to come to conclusions, but to go, these are the areas that we're going to hone in and zoom in and invest a lot of time in diagnosing and understanding this problem as well we can. The process that they then utilized was to then run a series of sims in both locations that replicated clinical work with some believable but not cartoonish distractions thrown in. And they ran those sims basically with as many times as possible with as many staff as they could to maintain clinical service and debriefed them. And the failure mode effects analysis is then described as a systematic proactive process for evaluating where failure might occur and then scoring the severity, frequency, and detectability of that event occurring. So it basically allows you to kind of tally up a relative risk stratification list, and then you can be informed by that and consider what issues you want to invest in solving or addressing. And the issues that they identified were then addressed in a number of different ways. And while I don't think that, you know, the specifics that they found in this unit need repeating in the podcast, from a discussion point of view, I think it did intrigue me in that at the nursing level, so during the checks, because nurses would normally be the ones checking and administering blood, there was a large volume of feedback regarding clarity of protocol and process, which is, you know, believable. While at the lab level, it was a very different type of feedback being received, which is that there was a lot of concern about the system, technology, and distractions. And if I was to uncharitably lean into stereotypes a little bit here, I'd argue that it's clear that, you know, a bit of reflexivity is required to interpret a debrief as data because, you know, even when you use a matrix, I felt like there were some cultural themes of the different healthcare streams that came out here because I think you know, protocols and policies are often very, very central to nursing practice and nursing education, whereas I wondered whether the crew in the lab were a little bit more technical, and so those things were coming out. And I suspect there were probably still some technical things that might have been caught up in the checks that maybe weren't as well identified in this process, but that's, you know, idle speculation. The article then describes the interventions that they implemented, and there's some nice ones in here. So there was human factors redesign and clarification of the protocols and guidelines, although we didn't get to see that, which I would have loved to. Installation of plexiglass to minimize distractions for lab technicians, which I thought was very cool, and movement of a printer to a different area so that less staff are actually walking through that area and creating distraction and noise, etc. And some education as well, which I thought was a nice nod that there, that is part of the solution, but it's not the whole solution. Overall, though, I thought it was a lovely example of the way sim can be used to inform and improve a process. There is a little bit of data at the end that suggests a trend towards lower errors in subsequent years. And I think, if anything, there's a missed opportunity here to dig into what they changed about their policies, because that remains a little bit hidden behind the veil in this article. How about yourself?
Well, I think this group are doing lots of work on systems-focused simulation, and this is one example that really illustrates that. So it's always enjoyable to read. I think one of the things that it illustrates is if we're using sim to explore phenomenon in a health service, that we reflect really hard on how do we best partner that with audits, data, and observation from the real world. And this shows that that was a sort of baseline entry point into this process, was knowing what's going on to begin with before you even start your sim-based exploration and or testing of better ways. I think it's very good reading for those of us who might not have as much grounding in quality improvement and who actually want to understand what a failure mode's effect analysis is and about how we might categorize risk according to its likelihood and severity, and thinking about that sort of a process, because I think we've all seen lots of people do sims and then find problems and then just send a long list of them to someone else to solve instead of having this more analytical approach, more granular approach. I think one of the things that I find quite hard, because I've currently got a similar article that I'm looking at for advances in simulation, and I'm not sure whether this, from a research scholarship point of view, is this an article seeking to validate a methodology, or is it an article about blood transfusion practice improvement in which sim is part of the methods? Can it be both? Maybe. But I think as a reader, what I really want to know about this is how much of this process is generalizable, how much did they learn about it, how much of it is context dependent, because I think there is a great tendency, although I love the case study, but do we go, oh, that was really cool, I should just do that too, or that was really cool, it worked really well, what bits of it can I now translate into my own context, which might be a different health service, a different country, a different context? And I would say, as one who does a bit of this myself, I think I can see those things in there. But as a reader, I might have just loved a little bit more explicit about that, because I don't think the authors mean we should just holus bolus do exactly what they did. And yet that's kind of how it's written. It's kind of like, we did this cool thing and we got good results. It was really helpful. And by the way, this is what we would recommend for others who might seek to do similar work.
I think that's very valid. Nice critique.
All right. Well, we're happy to go on to our next article, Ben.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Yes. Well, this one is titled, How Much Training is Enough? Low-Dose, High-Frequency Simulation Training and Maintenance of Competence in Neonatal Resuscitation. And I'm very biased with this article. It's by Joanna Haynes et al. From Stavanger, Norway, in Simulation in Healthcare. And as you might recall, I went to Norway last year and I was the first opponent for her PhD, and this was one of the papers in it. So I kind of had a little bit of a head start because I'd already read this as part of her thesis. But for our readers, to recap on this, the basic stuff is, look, neonatal resuscitation depends a lot on this skill of face mask ventilation. And this article seeks to build on existing knowledge that, of course, good sim training improves skills in this procedural task. But it looks at this question of, well, even once you've attained the skill, how often and how much training do you need to do to maintain competence? So as I said, the background to this, Joanna Haynes is part of a group that includes Hege Erstal, Siren Rettendahl, who have done a lot of work in neonatal resuscitation training, including in Tanzania, and all that beautiful work that they've presented on helping babies breathe. They've done it in collaboration with industry, with LADL. So they've got both training methods as well as devices and scenarios and pedagogical design that seems to work incredibly well, and they've saved many lives. But Joanna is looking at a similar question in a high-income country, i.e. Norway. So, as I said, in the study, they started with, look, not all babies are born screaming. Some need to have air pushed into their lungs to get them going. But that is not so easily done. And for some practitioners, they might not do this very often. So they have to obviously look at sim as a way of getting good at it. The other thing is, it's a complex enough skill that it needs a pretty clever mannequin. And in a previous study, they've described this Neonatally Live, which is a LADL product, which manages to emulate not just the baseline state of the neonate, but what happens after a period of time, because the lungs actually change a little bit as you start doing this ventilation. So the amount and frequency and various other things that you do have to change with that. So this is a very clever mannequin and a clever training process. So what did they do? This is part of the data they collected for other studies as well, but they took healthcare professionals from six different professions, so 156 all up. All of them had the initial training, and then they followed them over the next 9 months when they were asked to train independently. And all of them, if they were doing additional training, it was this high-frequency, low-dose training. So rock on up, do 5, 10 minutes on this mannequin, Do it as often as you like, but it actually isn't very much. It's a bit like you doing your Japanese on Duolingo, just short doses, but frequently. And then what they did was they assessed the skill levels that they were observing in this training on both global competence, but also some of the granular bits of what it takes to do this face mask ventilation. So one of the things I really liked about it was this was very real world. You do your training and then you get asked to do more, but everyone knows things get in the way of it. So what did they find? Because they were trying to find out what training load was predictive of success in terms of performance on the simulator. And they found out that in the 9 months, doing about 5 sessions predicted a high level of maintained skill. Now, that little sentence just doesn't do justice to the statistics and the various granular bits they did. But suffice to say, if you were training once every couple of months, it seemed like you managed to maintain your skills. And this was particularly relevant for all the groups other than the pediatricians who were doing most of the training in the real world and probably didn't need the sim training because they were doing a lot on real babies. So what are my comments? I think it's a really tricky thing to do, and I think they've done a lovely job of it. Pragmatism was the highlight of this study because they really looked at the sort of natural course of people's training in the real world. But they had a few advantages too. They had a really good mannequin. They had really good measures of success in terms of the sort of frequency and depth of ventilation and how well they got a seal on the mask. So they had these clever respiratory function monitors, and not all of our performance can be so beautifully measured and monitored. So this is a great place to start, but it does make me wonder how we extrapolate it to some of our more cognitive domain type activities. But I think a lovely way to set the standard of thinking, this is a really important question for probably everything we do. How do we maintain our skills? Well, Ben, you've probably done a bit more neonatal resuscitation than me. How did it land on you?
Yeah, very, very similar in terms of your impression. I loved it. And I think, you know, as you're describing the study, I think the Helping Babies Breathe program in general and all of that research that's been going on has been a real masterclass in picking a thing to focus on, both in terms of something that's measurable, something that's meaningful, something that can be, you know, reasonably easily trained, and then researching the crap out of it in ways that are just really, really impressive. I think for me, I agree. I was in much admiration reading it. I think it fits with what we know from previous publications on the importance of spaced repetition. And I think it, again, for me, really is just a point of reflection on thinking about, you know, how much we need to continue to add to organizational narratives about where spaced repetition fits in our systems. Because, you know, we certainly talk about it a lot at my stalk job where we run these courses statewide. We're giving them at a bolus dose that means long-term skill retention is unlikely to occur. And, you know, what are our strategies around that? And for us, it's to provide in situ sim packages in the hope that they'll be rehearsed. But I think when we look at the ways we assess CPR in our hospital still, while there's been many technological leaps in making that spaced repetition possible. I think when I talk to our nurse educators on the floor who are in charge of pushing those machines around and getting people to practice, it's still heavily undervalued in medicine and healthcare in general, I think. So I think this is another useful sort point of reference. I was a little surprised in the discussion that they seemed a little bit surprised almost that the time between those episodes of repetition was potentially different to what they'd found in CPR training, which to me wasn't really a surprise at all. Like, they just seem like completely different skills. But overall, just much admiration.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate enough to go and actually see their setup. And it literally is just another cot that you can go and do your training in. So it is pretty easy to do. So I can kind of see how they were surprised people didn't do more. But at the same time, and interesting, one of the things, and I don't know, I would hesitate to say I know the whole story about this, but one of the things is they've got a lot of cameras set up in their room as well. And that actually caused a little bit of grief for people because they were worried, in particular, about recording real resuscitations. And understandably, some people are anxious about that.
Yeah, I still don't get why we're more anxious about that as human beings than the actual resuscitation. Basically, we can be much more comfortable taking responsibility to make life or death decisions.
I know.
Than taking, you know, pursuing the possibility to get feedback on it that's actually accurate and based on evidence, which still seems entirely human but continues to confuse me.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I think lots of applicability, and clearly we need to do this kind of work for intubation and central lines and, you know, intercostal catheters. Just think about our worlds and the procedures people do. We have no idea what the forgetting curves are on those things. We barely know what the learning curves on those things are. And we've got thousands of practitioners out there doing a little play around every now and again, and it gets ticked off on their maintenance of professional competence.
Oh, so, and what do you choose when you've got a curriculum that's like, you know, can take you a decade to master anyway in some of these specialties?
True.
You know, there's still more things you have to learn? Like it's a crazy challenge. True.
All right. Well, many unanswered questions, but thank you so much for the excellent work. And Ben, you're going to finish off by talking about medical student consultations in pediatrics. It's been a little person theme.
Yes, yeah. So it's a nice little segue into the last one. And this again appealed to me for different reasons, but this paper is entitled A Comparative Analysis of Student, Educator, and Simulated Parent Ratings of Video-Recorded Medical Student Consultations in Pediatrics. It's published in Advances in Simulation by Claire Sullivan et al. And essentially, this article explores multi-source feedback for medical students on their communication during consultations with families on their pediatric rotation. And part of the reason it grabbed my attention is that it explores the use of simulated parent feedback in combination with self-assessment and supervisor feedback. So lots of different methods of feedback from lots of different lenses. And I think the secondary thing that it kind of intrigues me about is this sort of liminal space between the SP voice and the voice of the patient, and whether those are the same things or whether they're slightly different things, and we sometimes like to pretend that they are. So the research team took a series of med students through different simulated pediatric consults interacting with a simulated parent. So they were sort of talking parents through, you know, different types of healthcare problems, and the students then engaged in video-assisted self-reflection and received feedback from an educator as well as a simulated parent. And interestingly, they used two different scoring systems here. So with the educators and the students, we're utilizing the PCAT, which is Pediatric Consultation Skills Assessment Tools, whereas the simulated parents were given what's called a CARE measure, which is Consultation and Relational Empathy, which is a feedback form designed for patients to give feedback to clinicians. So basically what would happen is the students would engage in an 8-minute consult. They'd get 2 minutes of brief, focused verbal feedback from the SP as well as their peers. And then they'd go and watch themselves on video and score themselves using the PCAT tool. And then when they'd submitted their answer, they received the PCAT score from the educators who had been watching them, and then the CARE measure from the SPs. So two different scores and tool systems, in combination with them having to use one of them to rate themselves as well. So a lot of reflection and then also a lot of calibration from two very different lenses. The team collected the data from ratings from the students, SPs and educators alike, and then they explored the differences and consistencies between them. And in a pretty nice example of the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, the majority of the weaker students ranked themselves better than the supervisors thought they were, while the strongest quartile of students rated themselves lower than the educators did. What was interesting, though, and a little bit less expected, is that, interestingly, the SPs tended to be a little bit more extreme in their scoring. So strong students did really well, but weak students were ranked more poorly than by the educators. And there was also some discrepancy between the SP's perception of explaining things clearly and helping you take control, which were two of their criteria, with the SPs tending to mark more negatively for those than the educators or med students alike. We could consider that as a problem with the tool, but as the article notes, you know, this is potentially because medical educators also lack the insight into how non-medical people would actually like things broken down and what level is actually considered successful. So look, Vic, I thought the authors set out to replicate research that was already done on other populations. They were quite explicit about that. I think they found stuff that wasn't crazy surprising, but it was an interesting space to explore. And I think this idea of getting multi-perspective feedback is particularly useful. I would love to see a more qualitative follow-up to see how the students perceived the feedback that they were receiving from the SPs and the educators differently, because I think actually, well, you would be a lot more experienced with this, but I do wonder whether the SP feedback has a different type of weight to it based on that sort of overlap between patient advocate, patient experience, and educator feedback. What are your thoughts?
Yes, just on that last point, I'm always amazed at the real interest and intrigue with the feedback that our clinical teams get on our ED sims on a Thursday afternoon from simulated patients. People like hang on their every word. And I feel like you could just ask a real patient how you're going, but they don't. And they just love hearing from the SPs to that point about weight. You know, one thing, I agree with a fair bit of what you say. One is I always find it a little bit tricky when people use the scoring systems. And I'm not sure, maybe just because I don't have familiarity with them, how much validity to give them in any different context, and what does a number mean? So like you, I do tend to like more narrative, qualitative inquiries, but of course it's still useful. One of the things I wish we'd had was a peer feedback arm, because I feel like that's kind of an untapped potential. And if we're looking for what might be good sources of feedback, one of the cheapest and easiest and very well, or very common one in clinical practice is peer feedback. And I'm a bit sensitized by the fact that we did our peer-assisted learning sims with our Bond medical students on Friday. And it was just a delight. And to watch actually the skill at these colleagues assessing each other in the sense of, you know, watching them in a sim and then helping them and coaching them through feedback was really quite impressive. So anyway, they didn't do that, but I thought that would be another interesting arm to this kind of a comparison. And then the final thing I thought is, again, tricky, and I know that the paper just was setting out to look at the differences in assessment, but we know that that is only ever the first step in this process, because we're not just trying to evaluate medical students, we're trying to coach them. So whatever we come up with in terms of what we think about their performance, that might be useful if we're just using our sims for OSCE assessment type purposes. But certainly for me, my practice is almost 100% using sim for learning purpose, which means, of course, we make a judgment about how good we are. But we also go the next step, which is help them and coach them. And so I was kind of missing that bit of it. How would these three groups compare if they were not just trying to evaluate this or assess the student performance, but actually trying to help the student performance, in which case it might have been somewhat different in our outcome.
Ever the pragmatist, Professor Brazel?
Ever.
Excellent. I think that's really fair. And I think what's interesting is they identified the bias is the wrong word, but the value of the perspective of the SP and their different perspective on how much you need to break stuff down. And I think the thing you mentioned there about peer feedback is, you know, exposing our own bias a little bit as well, because we've measured everything else. We've acknowledged that peer feedback was happening, and then it actually hasn't been measured or considered as part of that process, either worth measuring, or it might have just been, you know, enough already to do the project as it was. I mean that not as critique of the study themselves, but I think that's certainly something we're probably guilty of a lot of the time in healthcare in general.
Oh, yes, in terms of the study, they did well not to go off on our tangents and just be disciplined enough to answer their question, their research question with the methods they did. Of course, they did a very good job of that. We're just meandering around in some other interesting and related topics. Yeah,
100%. Yeah. No, lovely.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Ben. Another four articles that were a pleasure to read and a pleasure to discuss with you. So thank you very much.
Absolutely, my friend. Well, you have an excellent month, and I'm looking forward to going down to Adelaide with you very shortly.
I know. We're looking forward to that. Mm. And for our Simulcast listeners, of course, we'll have the article links in our episode notes with Simulcast, and we'll look forward to talking with you in May. So this is Ben Simon, Victoria Brazel, signing off for Simulcast.
Thank you for listening to Simulcast.